Welcome to tonight's talk on women in science. My name is Beth Hannon. I'm the Associate Director for the Forum. And we put on events like this every week during term time. They're always free and you're all very welcome. We also make podcasts of our events, so if you can't make the event itself, you can find it on our website. Because we make podcasts, do be aware of that. If you ask a question, your voice will be recorded and it'll be in the public domain. And also, if you could turn off the sound on your phone, that would be fantastic. You can leave your phone on and live tweet. We've got a hashtag there, LSCFEP, if you want. I think that's it for me. Just welcome again, and I'm going to hand you over to Andrew, who is our chair for the evening. Thanks.
Great. So let me welcome you all to this event today. My name is Andrew Buskell. I am a fellow in the Department of Philosophy, Logic, and Scientific Method here at the London School of Economics. I'm joined today by three wonderful discussants. To my right is Kaylin O'Connor, Assistant Professor in Philosophy at the University of California in Irvine and researcher at the Institute of Mathematical and Behavioral Science. To her right is Dr. Patricia Farah, President for the British Society for the History of Science, Fellow of Clare College, Cambridge, and affiliated researcher in History and Philosophy of Science, also at Cambridge. And then to her right is Professor Melissa Hines, Professor in Psychology at the University of Cambridge, Fellow of Churchill College and Director of the Gender Development Research Center, also at the University of Cambridge. I'll start just with a brief outline of the structure of the event, and then we'll launch right into the discussions. So we have four topics that we're going to be addressing today, broadly about the structure, the history, and biological issues around the representation of women in science. Each of these issues will have an initial presentation from one of the discussants. We'll then open it up to the panel for some further comments, and then we'll throw out to the audience for questions. I should say that because this event is being recorded, if you do have a question, please put up your hands. I'll point you out, and then just wait for the microphone to get to you before you ask your questions. And we'll continue on until the very end, where we'll have a general discussion on the issue of women in science. So the first issue that we're going to be speaking about is why this really matters. Why should we care or worry about the representation of women in science? To introduce this issue, we have Dr. Kaylin O'Connor.
Thank you, and thank you to all the organizers for inviting me. Okay, so why do we care about the representation of women in science? I think there are two sorts of reasons to care about this, at least. One of these has to do with social justice. So why should women be in science? Well, because that's fair. Women want to have prestigious, well-paying jobs. Lots of women like science. And if women want to be scientists, they deserve the same opportunities to do so that men do. My guess is that most people in this audience will be on board with this, so I'm going to talk a little bit more about the second sort of idea. So philosophers of science have argued that, you know, even if we put aside sort of social justice reasons, there's another reason to want women in science, and this has to do with the success of science, that diversifying science matters for the scientific progress of our scientific communities. Now, this might sound like a kind of unintuitive thing to say, because the view, what we might call the sort of naive view of science that we all learn in high school, is that science is objective, you might have heard this, which might make you think, well, then it shouldn't matter who does science. You know, you do the pipetting, or you build the mathematical model, or you count the number of scrub jays in the field, and any competent person should be able to do that. And any person who does these sort of processes, the outcome should come out the same way, right? So philosophers of science have argued that this doesn't really capture what's going on in science. In fact, the makeup of a scientific community influences the outcomes of science. And in particular, the sort of identities and backgrounds of scientists influence how they do science. Why? Well, first of all, science isn't objective. But even if it wasn't, put that aside, scientists still have to make lots of choices. And there are many different ways to make these choices. And their identities influence how they make them. So I won't sort of go into all the ways that people have argued that identity sort of influences the way scientists work, but I'll give a couple examples. So one thing scientists have to do is choose what sorts of research programs to work on. What sorts of problems are they going to study? Your background, who you are, what you've been through, is going to determine what sorts of interests you have. So to give an example, in early primatology, most of the work in the field was done by male scientists. Most of it was done on male primates, so on male chimps, male baboons, male orangutans. A lot of this work looked at threat displays, dominance hierarchies, things like how do chimps build coalitions to take down the alpha male. The entrance of women into the field changed things, so sort of early female graduate students tended to be interested in female chimps and to study them. So in this case, the identity of the researchers impacted their interest in the research subject, broadened the field so that now people were looking at more problems, more topics, in a way that ultimately was very beneficial to primatology. Another example has to do with the background assumptions that scientists make. What things do they already believe to be true about the world that influence how they do their science? So who you are, what you've been through, is going to change what you believe to be true about the world in ways that can impact then what sort of science you do. So to give an example of how this sort of impact can happen, So in the late 60s, early 70s, economists got interested in the family as a unit of production. They started building models of the family to try to better understand this economic group. And all of these early models built by men tended to assume that you could treat the family as one unit, as one group with one interest. And the way they justified this choice was to say, well, what we'll do is just assume that each family is led by a benevolent dictator who makes choices for the good of the group. Right, you can laugh because we all know who the dictator is, right? It wasn't supposed to be mom. So in the 1980s, when more women started entering the field of economics, there were actually a number of papers written by female authors critiquing this assumption, saying, no, if we want to understand the family, we have to represent the heads of the household as having distinct interests that sometimes conflict with each other. So here was a case, and it doesn't seem like an accident that female economists were the ones writing these papers. You know, here's a case where it seems like their identities as women, probably their experiences in their own households, led them to critique sort of a bad assumption in the literature. Okay, so who you are influences how you do science. It's sort of an extra step to say, and it's better for scientific communities to have lots of different people of different sorts doing science. But the examples I gave are sort of suggestive of that being true. And in fact, if you look at the cases, in many instances, it is better to have people working on a broad set of topics or people with a broad set of assumptions so that they can critique each other's assumptions, point out where the other types of people are wrong. So why do women in science matter? Well, one reason is social justice. Another reason is that diversity might be good for scientific communities. So it's good not just to have women, but people of different racial, cultural, ethnic, all sorts of different backgrounds. For the success of science, this might be important.
That's great. Thanks very much. So we'll open it up now to Patricia and Melissa. Patricia, why don't you start?
Well, one of my favorite examples is to do with, it's the way that the metaphors that scientists use affect the way that we think about the world. And one of the very good examples is about fertilizing an egg. So that there used to be what's called the sleeping beauty model. So there's an egg sort of sitting there not doing very much, and then all these sperm come along like little sort of crusaders with sort of wiggling along, and the fastest and the quickest and the strongest is the one that manages to break through the chemical barrier and get inside the egg and fertilize it. But there's another way of looking at that, which is the sort of view of the world that might be put forward by a female scientist, and that is, so there's the egg with its chemical barriers around it, and the egg sitting watching all these silly little sperm trying to get there, and eventually the egg thinks, aha, that one's not so bad, I'll have that one, and it lowers, makes a little temporary hole in its chemical barriers, and it sucks the sperm in, and that's a that chemically, scientifically, both models make sense, but I think it's sort of the metaphor of how we think about the world is very, very profoundly affected by whether it's a man or a woman doing the scientific research.
Well, so in that particular case, people have argued that, you know, so in fact, many different types of eggs put out little projections to kind of pull the sperm in. Mm. These were first noticed in the 1890s, and people have argued, well, why weren't they sort of researched? Why isn't this in textbooks about fertilization? That in fact, it just didn't sort of go along with the metaphor of the sperm, like, fighting through the womb, penetrating the egg.
Fantastic. Melissa. Yeah.
So I come from a bit of a different perspective than my colleagues here, who are both in either history or philosophy of science. And I'm a neuroscientist, and I think many people who study neuroscience would be alarmed to hear that what they're doing is not objective. So I was wondering if you might be able to expand on that and say what you mean there. Because I think most people think science is objective. That's why we like it, because otherwise we just have opinions. Mm-hmm. And if we have science, now we can decide between these two opinions based on evidence, objective evidence even.
Great. So, and actually, in the sort of two examples I talked about, those weren't even critiques of scientific objectivity. So in the first example, people could be doing perfectly objective science, but just on different topics.
Yes.
So, you know, gender just matters to what they're picking. In the second example, you know, they could be doing science that's fine, but they've just missed an assumption. They've just gotten it wrong. So now someone comes and critiques that. So that's not even a failure of objectivity either. So it could be that all the neuroscientists are perfectly objective, but, you know, their identity still might matter to what they're doing. You could tell them that.
Well, that's great. We'll now open it up to questions from the audience. And just to remind you, please wait until the microphone comes to you before asking your question. So if you just want to raise your hands, I'll point to a couple of you. The woman there in the back, and then we'll come to you second.
Thanks. I just wondered if there'd been any data that was collected about how diversity in science makes science more productive. And in particular, at what levels do those benefits accrue? So, for example, at the level of the institution or the country or the field of science?
Great. We'll actually just take the second question first, and then we'll throw both questions up to the panel. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. I would like to ask if this diversity in beliefs is also a diversity or may be expanded as a diversity in skills among different genders.
That's great. So we have two questions, both looking at diversity. What are the benefits of diversity? Who benefits from this diversity? And what diversity sort of matters? I think these are really interesting questions. Caitlin, why don't you start us off?
So in regard to the first question, data on diversity in science, it's the kind of thing where when it comes to arguing that someone's background mattered to how they made scientific decisions, it's kind of hard to do that, right? It's hard to say the reason so-and-so did this instead of that had to do with their identity. So the examples that I gave and that Patricia gave were examples where it's very clear the science is about things like gender, right, or the household, about, like, men and women. So there you can make a kind of compelling case about, you know, gender playing a role in, like, the production of science. In more general cases, it's often harder to make. However, there are some ways that people have tried to get empirical evidence on the impact of diversity to things like discovery. So people sometimes do studies where they have groups of people doing problem solving. They look at, you know, mixed gender groups or single gender groups or, you know, other types of diversity in those groups and see how quickly do they solve the problem. And there's some evidence that having people, you know, with different backgrounds, different minds, different assumptions, does it, like, improve the sort of speed at which people problem solve. So that is, I think, the only evidence that I sort of know that's empirical gathered about this.
I would add some empirical data. A lot of the problems that we're going to be talking about that affect women in science are also true of women in other fields of life, such as politics or business. And there's been quite a lot of research done into boards of directors of companies. And what that shows is that mixed boards of directors the companies make a greater profit than ones which are either all male or all female or one particular ethnicity. So diversity really works because it stimulates people to have different ideas and they spark off each other. It also sort of broadens the base of people that you're catering for. So I think that sort of data is very relevant to women in science as well.
I should mention there are also studies on collaborations between scientists that are of mixed, like different genders or different races or the same genders and same races, and that data indicates that collaborative papers tend to be cited more. That doesn't necessarily mean they were better, but sort of numbers of citations from other scientists is a proxy for how much impact the work had.
I would agree. Again, I'm a bit of a fish out of water here, not being a historian or a philosopher of science.
Well, that's great. Why don't we follow up on that second question? What kind of diversity matters? What are we really talking about when we're talking about diversity? Is it just diversity in identities, or is it diversity in skills? How are we tracking these kinds of diversities, and which ones matter?
Well, so in philosophy of science, at least, people have made arguments that a lot of different sorts of diversity might matter to scientific communities. And they've made arguments that not just things like assumptions and problem choice, but also the methods you're using, things like skills, how good you are at things, might matter for the sort of progress of science. It might matter to have many different sorts of things. For things like skills, it's not always clear that skills line up well with certain personal identities, whereas things like problem choice and assumptions do tend to. So I don't, about that case, I don't know about particular instances like that.
It seems to me that diversity in skills is extremely important because the way that people tend to talk about the history of science is unfortunately in terms of great heroes like Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein or Charles Darwin. And the idea is that these people single-handedly solved a problem or invented a new bit of equipment or something like that. But of course that's patently untrue. If you've got someone who develops a new piece of machinery, for example, there's a whole team of other people who are actually doing the hard physical work of testing it and putting it together. Or for another excellent example is the atomic bomb, which had thousands and thousands of people working on it. So a large successful project in itself demands a diversity of skills and a diversity of approaches. And I think a lot of historians of science are trying to get away from this big single hero version of the past and create a more realistic model of how all the great discoveries and progresses always collaborative and cooperative.
Yes, and in this topic, I think it's interesting when you bring up skills, because skills are one things that don't differ that much for males and females. So, you know, there is a kind of popular mythology that men are better at spatial things and women are better at verbal things. But I think for skill sets like the ones we're talking about that make a successful scientist, men and women are equally qualified. So I'm not sure how much adding women into the mix is going to change the skill set, really. Yeah.
So diversity of skills might be really important, but that might be a bit orthogonal to gender, possibly.
I think that's an interesting issue and one that I hope will be addressed over the rest of the evening. Thank you, audience, for your questions. We're going to move on to the second question, which has to do with the history of representation of women in science. And here we turn to Dr. Patricia Farah. And I was wondering if you could speak about the history of science and how representation of women has factored into it, whether there are particular barriers, and if so, what are these barriers, and how have women in science overcome these barriers?
Well, the most obvious barrier for women in the past was that they weren't allowed to go to university until roughly the middle of the 19th century in this country, and they weren't allowed to join scientific societies. So that's obviously a huge obstacle. So at Cambridge, for example, women couldn't formally get university degrees until 1948, which is extraordinarily late. And even way up into the 70s and 80s in the top universities, there were far, far more places open to men than there were to women. And it's similarly at the Royal Society. The first female fellow of the Royal Society wasn't appointed until 1945. And there's a very famous example, a woman called Hertha Ayrton, who was one of Marie Curie's very, very close friends. She was a physicist, and in the early 20th century, she was nominated for a fellowship of the Royal Society, but she was turned down on the grounds that she was married. So those are the sort of obstacles that women at that stage were having to fight against. In a sense, before the 19th century, it didn't matter too much that women couldn't go to university because they were stuck at home, but scientific research itself was being done at home. There weren't public laboratories like there are now. So inevitably, there were a lot of women who were sort of incorporated within family endeavours, and that's particularly true of things like astronomy or people who were making instruments. The women were often very, very closely involved in it. Or as another famous example is the famous chemist, Antoine Lavoisier, who said to have revolutionised chemistry at the end of the 18th century during the French Revolution. And there's some marvellous drawings that were made by his wife showing her absolutely at the centre of the laboratory writing down all the scientific results. And when you look at the laboratory notebooks, her writing is all over them. So it's quite clear that she was organising the scientific endeavour of a family enterprise. And there's a lot of other examples of that. Another way that women could get around that obstacle is by having lots of money. They could pay for private tuition. So, for example, Margaret Cavendish was one of the ladies-in-waiting at the court of King Charles. And she married one of the richest men in the country, which is always a good move, and I recommend it. I've never quite managed to do it, but it's a jolly good idea. And he paid for her to have private tuition. He also paid for all her books to be published. So by the time of the 19th century in England, there was a sort of scientific dynasty, a sort of network where aspiring scientists would go to the houses of their friends and they'd line up all the daughters and see which ones they were going to be married. They would like to marry, because the daughters had been trained by the fathers and by their brothers to help out in the scientific research. So one very good example of that is Charles Lyell, who was the geologist who was very, very influential on Charles Darwin. And he picked out Mary Horner, the daughter of a scientist, and their honeymoon was a geological field trip. And then she was put in charge of his snail collection. If you're a geologist, snails and shells are really important. And there's a lovely letter she wrote to her sister about how she and her maid had become very expert at cleaning out the shells and the snails. So there was this whole sort of family stuff going on. There was also a bit relating to what I was talking about earlier. If you get away from a history of science that concentrates on great heroes, great discoveries, if you ask yourself the very basic question, how is it that in our society science has become so important and so dominant? Then you have to think about all the people who are doing things like translation, education, writing children's textbook, illustration, classification, editing, all those sort of tasks which aren't normally focused on. And of course, there were a lot of women who were taking on those sort of roles. So by the middle end of the 20th century, it was far easier for women to go to university. I think there was still a lot of discrimination against women. If you think there's a famous story of Rosalind Franklin that Watson stole her X-ray photograph and she never got the Nobel Prize, at least that's one version of events. Or else Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who discovered pulses when she was a postgraduate at Cambridge in the 60s. And she reported that every day when she went into the laboratory, she took off her engagement ring because she knew that otherwise she wouldn't be taken seriously. And I think it's those sort of slightly concealed prejudices, not so much the institutional ones, such as not letting women go to university, that can be legislated against, but what can't be legislated against is the attitudes that people have towards women. And over the centuries, there's always been this belief that women are inferior. I mean, it started with Aristotle. Men have got hot, dry brains, which are really good for thinking, and women have got these cold, wet, soggy brains, which really makes them very good at all the emotional stuff, but no good at thought. And then there was this problem with their wombs as well. I mean, the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb. So all women's problems were blamed on the womb, which was supposedly sort of wandering around their body somehow. Then by the time you get to the 19th century, well, women have got smaller brains. By the time you get to the 20th century, well, women have got all these hormones. So there's all these sort of rather insidious reasons why there's a general belief that women are inferior. And I think one of the most dangerous aspects of it is it's something that women at some level quite often believe in themselves. It's reinforced by the fact that women often get paid lower salaries for doing the same scientific work, so that reinforces the belief that women are only good for inferior positions. But you hear so many women in the past and also now sort of lacking confidence, feeling that they never apply for the top jobs. They don't believe that they're as good as the men. And this was confirmed in a horrible research study where they gave mock interview panels two sets of CVs. And the CVs were identical, but in one half was labelled as though it came from a man and the other half as though it came from a woman, and then it was reversed for the other interview panel. And the really scary bit is that the women, as well as the men on the interview panel, rated the male CVs higher than the female ones. And I think those sort of hidden prejudice, hidden beliefs are some of the most difficult that we have to overcome. And there's programs like the Athena Swan program, for example, is trying to counter that sort of idea. In practical terms, I think there is also the biological fact that it's women who have babies. Our chair, we have a different chair tonight because the chair who should have come is a man, but he and his wife had a baby yesterday, and I think that's absolutely fantastic. And it wouldn't have happened 10 years ago. It's absolutely fantastic that he didn't turn up tonight because he's with his wife helping to look after the baby. So I think the situation's improved enormously. There's far more equality in child rearing and caring for a family than there used to be, but it still remains the fact that partly because women tend to be paid less than men, it's generally the man who keeps the job and the woman who sacrifices her own salary in order to pay for the childcare. And I think in this country, until our government and our universities and our employers make a realistic bid to provide adequate childcare at people that prices can afford, I don't think we're ever going to get over this problem of having fewer women than men in high levels of science.
A very fantastic and comprehensive answer. So you spoke about institutional obstacles, social conditions, implicit attitudes, what we might address as epistemic injustice, a wide range of barriers that are unequal and varying over time. So now I just want to open this discussion up to the panel. Melissa, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, so I think you covered a huge range of history, and it rang several bells in my mind. One is that many people in this room probably don't realize it, but in the United States, most of the best universities in the country wouldn't take women at all until the end of the 60s, and actually was in the first class of women to go to Princeton. So yeah. I lived through that period, and it was just amazing to see the change in the institution from having women students there as well as men students.
But you did
there.
Have universities that were solely for women.
For women,
so
they
women could get higher education.
They didn't have the resources. Yeah. They didn't have the
Absolutely.
Same
yeah.
resources Absolutely. As Harvard, Yale, Princeton. There were some co-educational great universities like Stanford, but a lot of the best universities only admitted men. Yeah, so that in my lifetime that has changed. But another bell that rang is I have a colleague who studies the history of people taking mathematics. And in fact, the number of women going into mathematics up until about mid-1940s was increasing. And then it went way down again. So we think of things as progress and things are steadily getting better, but in fact there are historical events, and in this case the Second World War, which can cause social changes that result in going backwards instead of forwards.
Yeah, in the early 20th century, late 19th century, there were quite a few women doing maths at Oxford and Cambridge, which were the main places that women could go, because they didn't have to do the practical work. Women weren't allowed in the same laboratories as men, so if they wanted to do a scientific subject, a very high proportion of them did do maths. Although, of course, at Cambridge, the results were read out separately, so the men's results were read out and then the women's, and then there was this awful, awful year when a woman came top of all the exams, and so they that's called being the first wrangler at Cambridge. They still have this awful ceremony at Cambridge where they read out the results in public, going backwards, starting from the bottom. And anyway, so the year that this particular woman came top of the tripos, they read out all the men's results. And then they said, but a woman she can't get her degree, not till 1948, but she's been placed above the men. And there was this enormous cheer. All the women were in the top of the top balcony of the hall where this was being done, because they weren't allowed to mix with the men on the lower floor. I think one rather odd side effect of Brexit is that we are going to get far fewer students, unfortunately, coming from Central and Eastern Europe. And at Cambridge, anyway, very high proportion of our female maths undergraduates come from countries like Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, and they are no longer going to come. So as a consequence, Cambridge, and I imagine other universities, are going to go back to being primarily male. Maths is going to be primarily restricted to men. So it's one of the very, very, very many adverse consequences of Brexit. Am I allowed to be political? Sorry.
So I think it's reasonable to say that there are geopolitical barriers as well that prevent women from engaging in science, particularly if we have institutions, prized institutions, in sort of rich Western countries.
So I wanted to comment on this idea you sort of brought out about feedback mechanisms that keep women thinking they're not good at science, keep people thinking women aren't good at science. To connect that discussion to the previous discussion we were having, one of these feedback mechanisms is that sort of sexist assumptions people have feed into the science on gender differences. So if you read Darwin's work, of course he was living in the 1800s when everyone was massively sexist and racist, but he will say things like, obviously men are better at every single thing than women are, so we need to explain this. And he comes up with a whole theory to explain that, but he's just starting from that point, right? Mm-hmm. But then, of course, his theory is telling us that men compete with each other more, and so they get smarter, they get better at this, so we have a whole scientific framework confirming that women are worse at things, right? So he starts with the assumption, and then the output from the science feeds that very assumption. Or people have pointed out when it came to debates, early debates about women's intelligence, whenever people would have kind of findings that didn't match the sexist assumption that, you know, women are not as smart as men, they'd sort of change then what would prove that, right? So first the idea was like, well, whoever has the bigger brain-to-body ratio is going to be the sort of more intelligent sex, but it turns out that's women. Then it was like, oh, no, it's not brain-to-body ratio. It's actually the size of your frontal cortex, but it turns out that's women. Then it's not that, you know? So they keep sort of updating what science would prove that men are smarter, but here the sexist assumptions, eventually something will go in favor of men, right? And then the sexist assumptions make science that kind of feed themselves.
So you mentioned Darwin's idea about evolution. That was played quite a big role in the debates in the early 20th century before the vote was given to women in 1918. So a lot of people who are against the suffragist movement cited Darwin, and they said women are inherently inferior because over the millennia, over generation after generation, they've been conditioned to stay at home and look after the children, and that the men are much cleverer and much brighter. And some of these women, these supposedly dumbo women sitting at home, turned evolution to their own advantage, and they said, oh no, evolution is still happening, and the woman of the future is going to be politically aware and more intelligent. And they've so positively brought evolution onto their side in the campaigns for the vote.
think these are fascinating issues and ones that I think Melissa will be touching on, I think, in more detail in her question, in her subject area. But we're going to open up now to questions from the audience on these issues about barriers to women in science. And if you could just raise your hands. I have the gentleman in, I guess, about the fifth row in the blue sweater, and behind her, the woman in the gray blazer, and then I think we'll be able to get to you as well.
Hiya. I just wondered if I could raise a question about the historical representations of women in science, and I wondered how far you thought the choice of what constitutes science in the past limits how far women get represented. So, for example, as you were mentioning, in the 19th century, a lot of science is taking place in the domestic setting, and I think historians of science use the gentlemanly amateur model or something along these lines. But often women aren't accounted for who engage in works, popularization of science, and who are not publishing in scientific journals and these kind of things. So do you think that the choice of what constitutes science is limiting as to how far women are able to?
Yes, I think if you rewrite the history of science to talk about how science spreads, then women play a very prominent role. So let's give a couple of examples from the 19th century, seeing you mentioned that. In about 1820, something like that. At the end of the 18th century, a woman called Madame Marseille wrote a book called Conversations on Chemistry. The idea of it was that there was a mother and her two children, a girl and a boy, and she taught them how to do chemistry at home, and this was translated into languages all over the world. And one of the people who read it was a bookbinder's apprentice who was the son of a blacksmith. And this was his first introduction to science, and his name was Michael Faraday. And so the fact that we're sitting here with microphones and electric lights and everything else is arguably stems from Michael Faraday. So if you think about it like that, you can see this woman, Madame Marseille, having a huge influence. And he also always paid her great tribute right until the end of his life. Not all men did that, but he did. And the other 19th century woman, who I think is hugely important, is called Mary Somerville. And she was called the Queen of the Sciences. And so she translated French Newtonian books on astronomy into English. She didn't just translate from the French into the English. She also explained all the mathematics, because at that stage the French were all doing calculus and we weren't, because we didn't believe in calculus. So Mary Somerville explained it all and made it accessible not just to a popular audience but also to a scientific audience and to students. So the sort of rise of astronomy as a very important science during the 19th century, again, owes quite a bit to a woman. And there's loads of examples like that. So it's just getting a different perspective on how you write your history. And it's sort of rather like the examples we were hearing earlier. Instead of focusing on the men, you ask different questions about the rise of science, and then the women come to play a far more prominent role.
That's great. We'll take the remaining two questions and then throw it back to the panelists. So we have the woman in the gray blazer.
Hi there. Well, we have women excelling in science as well as men, but there are still some underlying sexual assumptions in work.
Can you hear what you said? Could you speak a bit louder or nearer the microphone? I'm afraid I can't really hear.
So we have female excelling in science today, and as well as men, but there are still some sexual assumptions from different people in the world of work. How do you think we can make females more prominent to support the idea that females are equal?
Great, thank you so much. And we'll just get the last question from the gentleman just behind.
It sort of picks up on that. I think we don't have enough role models. And we've got the stereotypes, you think you've identified, Michael Faraday as an engineer who's had a great involvement in the future of the country and the world. I can't think of many women who will actually have the same impact. So if you ask, go to schools, name an engineer, they'll probably think about a man rather than a woman, because I don't think there are sufficient role models promoted across in the whole of the STEM philosophy. So I don't know what you think about how we can change that. And I don't know whether it's the same in the States as well as it is in the UK.
That's great. So we have three questions about whether women have been sort of suppressed because of the nature of science, what we call science. We have questions about what we can do to make women more prevalent in science, as well as is there maybe a bias in the way in which we promote certain people within science? So I think a bunch of really interesting questions about the way in which women are portrayed and represented in science. Caitlin, do you have anything to contribute to these questions?
Well, so as far as the question of how do we promote women in science, how do we actually get more? I mean, this is a really important practical question that a lot of people in governing bodies are working on. One sort of thing, I mean, one real problem with promoting women in science has to do with implicit bias. So these studies were mentioned where you send people perfectly identical resumes and they tend to hire the one with the male name over the one with the female name. They also tend to offer them higher salaries. Incidentally, people have done the same study outside of science with like white people and people of color and with LGBTQ people and straight people, and you get sort of the same effects, right? So there are implicit biases that are sort of preventing women from moving up the ladder in science. So there are different ways to combat those. One way is to try to get people to control their own implicit biases. And so there have been studies done indicating that if people really understand that communal norms are against bias, that people don't think it's acceptable, that does impact how they make their judgments. Giving people more time to try to make judgments that are more objective and less kind of seat of the pants just based on something about that person, just something seems like she's not that smart, you know, to give them more time to make judgments work. Also, you can just put institutional things in place that prevent implicit bias from acting, so things like blind peer review. So many journals recently have stopped sending papers with the author's name on them to reviewers to look at. So now reviewers get a paper with no name on it. Then they make a judgment of the paper. Then the paper is published. And that things like that can help women get sort of a fair shake in the sciences.
There's also sort of cues, for example, in scientific laboratories or in academic buildings, making sure there's pictures of women on the wall so that it's not just a whole crowd of men on the wall. Things like making sure that there's lots of articles and books by women in the reading lists. I think also we have to get a bit of a sense of perspective about this. I mean, the fact that we're all here discussing this is in itself a great sign of progress. I mean, even 20, 30 years ago, I think there were far fewer women in science than there are now. There was certainly far, far less awareness of the problem. And I think thinking about the problem is the very, very important first step towards solving it. So I don't think we should get too depressed about it. I think things are improving, and they've certainly improved enormously in my lifetime.
Yes, so there is a lot of psychological research, a lot of different labs around the world trying to figure out what to do about this kind of problem, not just around gender, but also, as has been mentioned, about around race and other difference. And one thing that's been identified, in addition to what's been mentioned, is how we think of ability. So thinking of it as something that we've either got or we haven't got is really counterproductive. And in fact, it makes people in these groups that aren't part of the current system think they don't have it. So there's research showing, and quite a fair amount of research showing, that if you help students to see these abilities that relate to science, say math, physics, calculus, as something that is acquired as opposed to some gift that you might be born with, it gets more people from disadvantaged groups into doing well in these areas. But and that's just one example. There are many, many, many studies trying to see how to address these issues.
So philosophy is a discipline where there's an idea that you're either brilliant or you're not. In fact, I've often jokingly heard it called beaminess, where it's like you shine your philosophical beam on any problem and then you should be able to solve that problem in like a matter of minutes because you're so smart. But it's been argued that this has really deterred women and people of color from entering philosophy, and there is a huge gender representation problem in our field.
I think that's right. Actually, just to segue and to continue these issues, we'll move on to our third topic, which concerns neuroscientific evidence about sex differences, whether there's a male brain or a female brain. And so we have an expert on neuroendocrinology and developmental psychology, Melissa Hines, to introduce us to issues around the neuroscience of sex differences and what this evidence actually shows.
Okay, I'm going to come over here because I want to show you some images. First, just to identify me. And if you're interested, well, let me go back a bit. So I run the Gender Development Research Center at Cambridge, and we're interested in a broad range of gender-related outcomes, including why are certain areas of science, in particular, predominantly male. And if you went online and tried to get some information on this topic, you'd probably see one of two very different views. You'd be very confused because you might run across a book like this one, and this is just one example. There are several of these books, and they keep coming out year after year, called The Female Brain. And Brinzadine argues that men and women are hardwired to be different. This is computer wire that making up that female brain. So she says things that happen before birth are genetic makeup. Hormones that are present in the womb make the female and the male brain very different, and among other things, this makes men more likely to be scientists. In contrast, you might pick up Cordelia Fine's book. Again, there are lots of books taking this point of view called Delusions of Gender, where she argues that all of the evidence saying that genes or hormones influence gender development is flawed, and in fact, it's all down to socialization. If you look more broadly, if you get involved on a very basic level looking at everything that's available, I hope that you, like me, would conclude that they're both right to some extent, but they're both wrong by leaving out the other part. And like most behaviors, gender-related behaviors develop based on a lot of different factors interacting over time. And these include the sex chromosomes, sex hormones, particularly testosterone before birth, socialization by parents, peers, teachers, and strangers. I don't know how genital arousal to sexual stimuli got there. I'm sorry about that. It snuck in from a different presentation. Like I said, we're interested in all gender-related things. And so there's a lot of research on socialization. You know, kids get encouraged to do different things based on whether they're a girl or a boy by most everyone. And then children self-socialize. So they learn I'm a girl or I'm a boy. They look around the world. They go, ooh, girls aren't scientists. Boys are. And they kind of emulate that behavior. And all of these are important. I, in fact, spend a lot of time studying the influences of testosterone prenatally on later gender-related behavior. And the idea that there might be some influence is based on a huge body, thousands of studies of non-human mammals showing that testosterone influences brain development and behavior prenatally. And I and other people have looked at the possibility that this applies to human development as well. And we have concluded that it applies to gender childhood play behaviors, like why girls like dolls and boys like trucks on average, gender identity, whether you think of yourself as a man or a woman, sexual orientation, whether you're attracted to men or you're attracted to women. The one area where we haven't found consistent evidence is cognitive abilities. So I am not persuaded that cognitive abilities, like, say, spatial or verbal abilities that the general public thinks show big sex differences, relate to testosterone prenatally. You'll also see I put up IR, independently replicated. So in science, you know, you often read about this study proves this. That's rubbish. No single study proves anything, by and large. In science, lots of people look at the same question. It's important that not only one laboratory finds something, but also that another laboratory finds the same thing independently. And that gets back to some of the questions about how objective science really is, given that we have ourselves doing the science, and that can contaminate what we find. So if you look at cognitive abilities, you might find a study that suggests that testosterone increases people's spatial abilities or makes them worse at verbal things. But if you look across all the studies, you'll find that at least as many studies don't find that to be the case. So that's why there are question marks there. So this idea that testosterone somehow makes your brain better at science, has been put forth, and people talk about male brains and female brains. I don't know how many of you saw an article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago about this exhibit at the science exhibit, the Science Museum here in London, that says what sex is your brain, and you can take some simple little cognitive tests that by and large don't show very big sex differences, but somehow it will tell you if you have a pink brain or a blue brain. And lots of neuroscientists, not me, but neuroscientists, many from UCL, some from other parts of Britain, said this is really rubbish and it shouldn't be there. So I don't know if it's going to continue to be there. But this is a kind of popular idea about male brains and female brains, and male brains being better at science. So why do people think this? Well, I think partly it's a misunderstanding of the brain. Everything we do is based on our brain. So every time you learn something, every time you change your behavior, your brain changes. Okay, so it's not something that's fixed that you were born with and it's never going to change. And it's a mosaic. Some parts of it might be more male typical. Some parts of it might be more female typical. Most of us have a bit of both in our brain. Also, people believe this because it fits our stereotypes. We see men being scientists, and so we think they must be better at that. And it's also a misunderstanding of the size of gender differences in things. I said, you know, it's a myth that men are better at spatial things and women are better at verbal things. If you break it down into little teeny categories of verbal ability and spatial ability, there are some average differences. But these differences are relatively small. So to put them in a familiar context, we know men are taller than women, but there's quite a bit of overlap. Some women are taller than some men. The biggest of these cognitive gender differences is less than a third the size of the gender difference in height. So lots and lots of overlap. Also, there's something called just world thinking. People like to think they live in a just world. Things are the way they are because that's the way it ought to be. It saves you a lot of worry to think that, but in fact, it might not be true. People also have a way of thinking either or. So if they read something like testosterone influences children's play behavior, they think socialization must not be important. But we know, in fact, that both are important. It's not one or the other. And people overgeneralize. So they see testosterone as important for children's play behavior. Oh, that must explain why men are more likely to be scientists, too. So what's the way forward? Well, I agree with others on the panel that we want more people, men and women, to be scientifically literate or even to be scientists. And I would add a third reason to the ones that were mentioned before, which is this is good for society. It's not just good for science, not just social justice. We need people, everyone, to know more about science as we have a more technological world. And why would we want to focus on things like genes and hormones when we're thinking about how to accomplish this goal? Why not focus on those parts of the system that are easier to modify, like social attitudes based on socialization practices or self-perceptions related to people's cognitive understanding of gender, rather than those that are harder to change? And I just want to finish with some pictures that, from my personal history, I mentioned I grew up in a time when women didn't go to the best universities or many of the best universities in the United States. Also grew up in a time when most political leaders were men. This is a picture of John F. Kennedy getting sworn in. There's only one woman in the room. It's his wife. So all of his advisors are men. 10 years later, and this is my own little history and philosophy of science, my amateur attempt. 10 years later, Nixon's cabinet, more people, but none of them are women. But finally, 2012, you've got a third of those advisors are women, and there are also more people of color. So things in that arena are improving. Right now, we've got a woman prime minister, a woman chancellor of Germany, woman running Scotland, woman maybe soon running the United States. Wouldn't that be exciting? So if we can have this kind of thing changing in politics, we've also seen it changing in medicine, changing in law, why not science?
That's great. Thanks very much. So you've introduced a wide range of issues. What does it mean to be hardwired? What are some of the cognitive biases that might go into these judgments? What does it mean to have evidence of sex differences? So I'll open this up to the panel. Caitlin, maybe you have something to say on these issues.
Yeah, well, so the sort of area in science of studying innate gender differences in the brain is a really fascinating one from the perspective of philosophy of science. Because as you mentioned, it's this area where the sort of eventual differences in the brain are caused probably both by innate factors and by factors like socialization. So the question of how do you get evidence just for innate gender differences is a really fascinating question, one that's very hard to figure out. So if you look at all the research on whether men are in fact better at math than women, people do all these tests where they test, you know, 10-year-olds on some particular math test. But if they find that 10-year-old boys are better at math than 10-year-old girls, well, those kids have already gone through 10 years of gender socialization that are tracking them on different trajectories. So that doesn't tell you about innate differences in the brain. You have to come up with these sort of creative ways to figure out about it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as well, because you in several of your slides, you had pink for women and blue for men, or pink for girls, blue for boys. And I think that is one area in which we have definitely gone backwards. If I go into any toy shop, or any children's clothes shops, the amount of pink stuff for girls is absolutely, absolutely extraordinary. I even saw a program about guns in America where they had pink guns for the women and blue guns for the men. And I mean,
that's so sorry for our country.
No, I'm sorry, but I mean, that means that sort of subconsciously, from when a baby is absolutely minute, this idea is being reinforced that pink is for girls, blue is for boys, therefore girls and boys are different. And it's really, really difficult to get over that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when my little story about my kids, when my twins were only a year and a half, like tiny toddling babies, they were already showing preferences for pink and purple, which, I mean, we know that can't be innate, mm-hmm. right? That has to be socialized.
Well, people have actually suggested that that's innate, too.
No, because in the late 19th century, it was the other way around.
Well,
that,
it wasn't so much. Actually, this is one of the things I've done a lot of research on. And it wasn't that blue was for girls, but until the Second World War, pink and blue were equally for girls and boys.
Oh,
so
okay.
So the point you're making is well taken, that it's arbitrary, and people actually learn color preferences. There's a man named Stephen Palmer at UC Berkeley who gives people different drinks, for example, nasty-tasting green drinks and nice-tasting blue drinks. And then he does very sophisticated assessments of their color preferences, and having a nice-tasting green drink makes you like green better. And he's shown that students at UC Berkeley, where the school colors are blue and gold, like blue and gold better than students at Stanford, where the colors are red and white, and those students like red and white better. So, we've done a bit of research with children suggesting the same thing. And the sex differences in color preferences in this culture come into play shortly after children start playing with sex-type toys, and they are, as you know, pink. So girls play with pink things, they come to like pink. And you don't see these color preferences in cultures where they haven't been exposed to our pink and blue color coding. So I think the evidence there, you're right, is that these are arbitrary. I think toys are different, but colors, I think, are arbitrary. But people arguing from an evolutionary perspective have suggested that pink used to be more what you would look like if you were foraging for berries. Yes, we laugh, but this was published in a highly regarded journal.
Yeah. Well, these are fascinating issues, and I think we'll open it up to the audience to ask a few questions. So if I could just see some hands, I'll be happy to pick some people out. We'll start with the woman here on the left. Oh, another one in the front. Well, we'll get to you in a second.
Shall I go ahead?
Please.
I just wanted to say that I think it's important to disambiguate mean differences from differences in variance. And means are so much easier to get hold of and think about. And we're not used to thinking of variance as being a thing, because variance is the set of differences in a measured population. But small differences in variance can have outcomes that are associated with gender, and they may be nothing to do with mean differences.
That's a great question. We'll move over there very quickly.
It's quite a practical question about picking up on your point about who's getting into Cambridge to do maths. So in the last few years, A-level results have been better for girls than boys. And I was wondering if you thought that that would have an effect on topics like this, and also whether you think that, you know, a lot of people are complaining that we focus too much on exams in academic performance, but maybe that's actually a good thing for women, because women are doing better that way. And now, you know, you don't really have people like Faraday teaching themselves science. It is more regimented, and that will maybe work in women's favor.
Great. So two questions. One statistical question, just asking, maybe Melissa, you can speak about this, the difference between mean differences and differences in variances, which might be interesting, especially considering your example of height. And then maybe we can talk about the second interesting question about formats or modes in which we can start to maybe eliminate these sex differences.
Okay, so the variance issue is one that has been debated extensively by psychologists and evolutionary psychologists in particular. And it's a hard one to address for many reasons, because first of all, and it's been applied quite a bit to IQ scores. So men and women don't differ on the average in IQ scores, but some people have presented data suggesting there's more variance in men. So the best study based on the most comprehensive data set that I've seen is from a study published in Psychological Science several years ago. And that study suggested that, yes, this was the case, but mainly it's because there are a lot of men at the very low end of the distribution. And that's probably because males are more susceptible to developmental insult because the X chromosome lack some genetic information. If they have a faulty Y chromosome, they're less likely to be able to compensate. But even though there was mainly about low end of the distribution, there was also a bit of it at the high end of the distribution. So then you have to ask the question, how does that happen? How did that come to be? And you can't assume that that's because of something inborn. Men and women, girls and boys, are treated very differently. From the moment of birth, girls usually get things like, oh, isn't she pretty? Isn't he clever? So you can't just say that that's inborn. You have to then say, why? Is there something different about the way girls and boys are socialized that cause the ones who are at the very extreme top of the distribution as well as the extreme bottom to be more likely to be male?
Yeah, on your question about the exams, I think one problem in this country, perhaps not so much in other countries, is the way that maths is taught. And there's a lot of girls' schools where they don't have very good maths teachers, and so maths isn't taught to a sufficiently high standard for young women to get into Cambridge. And that's a real problem. It's also a problem that affects state schools versus private schools, as a lot of state schools don't have adequate maths teaching. That's part of the problem. The thing about exams, about, I don't know, 15 years ago, something like that, Cambridge did a lot of soul searching, and several faculties, including the department that I'm in, reduced the emphasis on exams because we thought that would boost women's results. So now in my department, you can do, in your final year, you can do 40% of it by essay and dissertation rather than by exam. And actually, it didn't make any difference at all to the proportion of women and men that were getting first and two ones. So there has to be something else going on. I mean, it's a very difficult topic, I think.
The suggestion does relate to this idea that I suggested before, how do we get women in science? Well, we need ways of judging, promoting, that are, you know, not influenced by people's implicit biases and their stereotypes about men and women. And exams are something that are more objective than someone sitting down looking at a candidate and judging them with all of their implicit biases. Yeah. There have at least been some historical cases where using exams for admissions did lead to more fair results. So yes. At Harvard in the early 1900s, they switched their admissions to be entirely dependent on a test. And the next year, the proportion of Jewish students went up, I mean, from like none to 30%, something like that. Of course, they immediately got rid of the exams and added an interview to judge the character of the students. So it didn't end up working out there, but that was a case where at least, you know, if the exams had been implemented, they're giving a sort of more objective measure of all the students.
Absolutely, and it's the same. AS level used to provide universities with an objective nationwide way of comparing students, and the government is putting huge pressure on all universities to take from a wider diversity across the social classes. And AS level represented one of the most effective ways that we could do that. But thanks to Michael Gove, we no longer have AS level, so the government is sort of fighting against itself on that one.
Well, I think that the issues that we're addressing now are a great segue into the final topic that we'll be discussing today, which is what can we do to improve the next generation of women in science? What are some of the mechanisms or the procedures, the movements by which we can inspire such that we can help the next generation. And this will just be a general discussion, and if we have time, we'll open up for some questions from the audience. But Melissa, why don't we start with you? What can we do to improve the next generation, to increase representation of women in science?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that we can do. And one of them is based on the research showing that if people see things not as gifts, but rather as things that have to be acquired, that would be helpful. Another is that we need to make people aware of their implicit biases. Often they aren't. I want to mention another strand of research that shows that people justify their decisions retrospectively. So in this research, people saw applicants, and some of the applicants had more education and some had more experience. And when the experience and education in a male and female were equal, people said education was more important. And so they would pick sometimes the man, sometimes the woman. If the woman had more education and the man had more experience, they tended to pick the man, and they said it's because experience is more important. And when that was switched, so that the woman had more of the other, they then changed their criteria and still picked the man. So I think we have to make people aware of the complex ways in which they justify making certain sex-biased decisions that they tend to make.
Do you think that there is a way in which we can make those results more prominent, or are there particular kinds of mechanisms you think we should introduce in universities or in culture at large that might make these more prevalent and more visible?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm open to all suggestions on that topic. Yeah. So I guess get the BBC to do a story on it. For some reason, I think, you know, looking at my own research, which often involves hormones, the press is much more interested in that than they are in socialization. And I imagine that's because the public at large is more interested in that than they are in studies showing the impact of socialization.
Or maybe it's just another example of people wanting to retrospectively say, well, I was right all along. There are female brains and male brains, and by gum, I was right.
But why would someone want to do that to begin with? That's the question.
There are assumptions. They're different assumptions. So one way that's been helpful to me in thinking about increasing representation in science is to think about sort of two things having to change. So one is breaking down barriers to women entering science, and we've talked about that when we've talked about, you know, implicit and explicit biases, how to reduce their effects. And then the other is changing women's desire or their feeling that they can be scientists. So that's come up with changing the way people think about science, so they think about kind of a growth mindset and skills that, you know, these are talents that all sorts of people can acquire. They're not just born brilliant at science or not. And also, I forgot the other thing I was going to say.
You've got a woman's brain, that's your problem.
Yeah, right. It's my hormones.
I think there's a lot of sort of ways that people have suggested for improving the number of women in science. such as role models, for example. So I think there is a cumulative process. I mean, we're sitting on this platform, there's three women. I don't know why we're being chaired by a man, but anyway, there's three female academics sitting in front of an audience which is primarily women. So that in itself, I think, is an indication that there are far more women in senior academic positions. There is now the situation in most universities that there's roughly equal numbers of men and women entering science, particularly in the biological sciences and medicine. There tend to be more women than men, not so much in sort of physics and computing. There is still very much the problem, the leaky pipeline problem, as it's called, that once you get to the higher levels, there's fewer and fewer women at the top. But I think that is something that is partly improving because there are examples for other people. So it's less extraordinary to see a woman in a senior position than it was 10 or 20 years ago. But the other thing, I mean, I've already touched on this when I was speaking before, I mean, I really do think that substantial investment has to be made into effective childcare provision so that parents in a family do not have to choose between a family life and an academic life. It's part of a sort of broader shift in what people think is important. Is it important to go and spend 24/7 in a laboratory, or is it important to balance that with some sort of family life at home? And I think if the childcare issue were properly addressed, I think we'd see far more women in higher positions in science.
I mean, one thing that's probably also worth mentioning is just problems in some disciplines with straightforward sexism and sexual harassment as well. So, you know, people think a lot about implicit bias because everybody has them, they're tricky to get rid of. In a lot of disciplines, you know, younger graduate students, for example, also just experience harassment. So I think it's, you know, an important step to getting women to remain in the sciences is also universities taking steps to be on the side of female academics when they say, I'm in a toxic environment or a sexist environment or an environment when I'm experiencing harassment, to say, well, yes, we believe you and we're going to actually take steps to change that.
I think a lot of change as well, both in the past and also now, depends on the initiative of a few individuals. So you see so one department, which is in one university, which is almost entirely women, and then you see the same subject in another university, and it's almost entirely men. And certainly in the past, a lot of the women who've been, like Dorothy Hodgkin, for example, who's still the only British female Nobel Prize winner, the way she was able to get to the top was because she was encouraged by Bragg. So I think this thing of having a few people who set examples, who really want to shift the culture, I think that's also important. So you get local pockets where things work far better than they do elsewhere.
I think that these are picking up on many of the barriers that you were talking about earlier, Patricia, not only these institutional issues, but these social issues. Something that you spoke about earlier, Melissa, was this issue of scientific literacy. What role do you think that can play in not only breaking down these barriers, but maybe even motivating, to pick up on what Kaylin was saying, motivating more women to be in science?
Yeah, I think I'd like more people of both sexes to be in science. I'm a scientist, and it's terrific. It's a great thing to do with your life. I've enjoyed it enormously. But I find that the educational system that sort of lets people stop taking science at a very early age doesn't help at all. And women are the people who are more likely to stop taking science. But I think there needs to be a basic change in the educational system to get people to take science, everyone, at a higher level, because people just can't even understand the conversations about science if they don't have a certain level of basic understanding. And people don't know what they want to do with their life when they're 15, 16, 17-year-old. But if you close that off at that age, it's very hard to get back in. So I think if we were to get people taking science at a much higher level, both male and female, more females would be able to go on as well.
Great. Well, we will open it up for questions from the audience, maybe even suggestions from the audience. We'll start with a woman, I guess, midway back in the red.
And there's a woman with the orange sweater.
Sorry,
to ask something.
That's what I meant.
Oh.
Red or orange. Well, then we'll go all the way to the back to the woman in white, and then we'll we'll come sort of midway down here, and then maybe if we have time, we'll come up right here to the front. So please, go ahead.
So I just wanted to ask about practical things that can be done for women in science in academia. One thing that wasn't mentioned, actually, probably mentioned a little bit, actually, by you, I think it was that you have to move around so much during that time where most women tend to have children, if they have children. And so it seems to me like fundamentally the academic career needs to be changed, the structure needs to be changed significantly. So like I'm in theoretical physics and, you know, there are no women lecturers in my department. And I really think that it, you know, there needs to be a fundamental change that for 10 years you're not moving around, you know. Have you heard of anyone talking about that, like in government or any funding bodies, you know, anything, basically?
Well, I think that's related to with something which I think they have got much better organised in America than they have here, that they make, if they appoint either a man or a woman in a university, they quite often create some position for the partner, whereas in Britain that's virtually unheard of. So then if you've got the situation that the couple is going to be on opposite sides of the world, it's quite often the woman who sacrifices her position because she's earning less than the man. So I think that's a related problem. It's a thing of joint appointments. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No. I mean, it's certainly, I think, not lost on people thinking about this, that this period that's absolutely crucial for an academic career from, you know, your late 20s to through your 30s is the same period where, you know, women, if they want to have children, they've got to do it then, right? So I think there's been a lot of discussion about what sorts of ways can we make this feasible for women. This is one way. You know, trying to improve spousal hiring programs so that people can stay together as a family unit, even if they have to move around maybe for several postdocs. But I think there could be other things like, you know, trying to get lab sciences to extend the length of postdocs so that if you finish your PhD when you're 28, you can expect to be somewhere for 5 years or something like that, rather than having to go 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, bounce all around. Something like that could really help women in science who want to have a child.
And again, going back to the childcare issue,
yeah.
If you had inexpensive childcare that was convenient, that would make it a lot easier.
And also, I mean, it's inherently inefficient. If you've got these one-year positions, you're inevitably spending quite a high proportion of that year looking for where you're going to go next and worrying about it. I mean, it seems very counterproductive to me.
And figuring out where the laundry machine is.
Yes.
I mean, also, I think it's increasingly the case that in many disciplines, people are thinking about childcare, breastfeeding, you know, birth as part of what people in the discipline will be doing, and those are really good changes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in philosophy of science, we're about to have the first conference meeting that will have childcare at the conference. And increasingly, conferences will have, you know, a breastfeeding room for women to go to. And sort of the more we do that, the more accessible things are for women during that stage of life.
Great. We'll move to the woman just at the very back.
Hi, I work in a university where I focus on increasing gender equality in the sciences. And my question was around how do we engage men in the process of increasing gender equality? Where I work, a lot of the initiatives that are done to increase gender equality are quite overrepresented, if you like, of women. So what are your thoughts on that? Thank you.
Well,
so the question was asking, how do we motivate men to get involved in the movement to increase representation of women in science, maybe even if it's against seemingly their best interests?
I think we need to educate them that it's not against their best interests. Yes, that in fact, as was pointed out, diversity is a good thing. So you want to have as many types of people as possible doing the science for the society.
I mean, this question, you know, sort of hints at something important, which is that whenever you want to engage in social change, especially if you're in a disempowered group, you want to get allies from, you know, the sort of more traditionally powerful groups, right? So it's an important thing to get men in science to also care about representation. I think in some disciplines this has just been done through public discussion. You know, we just keep talking about why gender representation matters, the fact that implicit bias is real, why it's important for departments to hire women, to promote women, et cetera. And then that, you know, in some places at least has caused positive change.
One issue that we haven't really touched on is positive discrimination. And people have very different opinions about that. But I personally am rather opposed to it, because then it opens the door to people to say, oh, well, she only got the job because she's a woman. So it seems to me that that's a rather risky route to travel down.
Right. We'll move to the woman in blue, sort of midway up. Oh, no more questions? Oh, yeah, sorry.
There was a woman in the front.
I think hello. So my question's sort of more about the role of the individual in all of this. I think we mentioned medicine being one of the disciplines that has now got more women in, and I'm a medical student at the moment. And I personally have experienced a lot of sort of outright sexism, as well as there being a lot of areas of medicine I wouldn't go into because it's still very male-dominated. So I suppose my question is, given that we do still live in this world where there's inequality, what can the individual do on a day-to-day basis to mean that women do go into those areas and their sort of working life is bearable?
I mean, I think that for women in these areas, so I'm in a field that's about 15% women, philosophy of science, there can sometimes be a tension between the things that you do to promote your own career and to try to change the place you're in, right? So, you know, on one hand, you'd like to make things less sexist, less bad in medicine, right? But on the other hand, you also sort of want to get by and get in. And I at least don't have a good answer about which one of those things is more important, because it's important for women to move into these fields. Sometimes the best way for you to do that is to laugh it off, you know, and get the letter from your advisor, even if he's making inappropriate comments or something like that. And then once you're there, you can help other women in. But at the same time, maybe talking to him would be better. I don't know.
And it's also a problem if you get women who are professors or in very high positions in a university, they get spread really thin because everybody insists now that every committee has got to have a woman on it, but there's so few women at the top that they don't have time to further their own career because they're so busy sitting on committee meetings. I think that's a problem as well. And I think you also have to develop slightly a tough skin. I mean, I've been on loads and loads of committee meetings where I'm the only woman in the room. And I think you really have to have the courage to sort of speak out. And as a sort of practical tip, if you're a woman in a room where there's only men, and if you speak very, very near the beginning of the meeting, then the sound of a woman's voice seems natural. Whereas if you wait until the end of the meeting, it strikes a very jarring note for the woman to speak. This was a tip that a woman gave me a long while ago. So whenever I'm in a meeting and they're all men, I try very hard to say something right at the beginning so that people get used to the sound of a different voice.
Wow. Fascinating. And the woman in blue just up at the front. Sorry, a couple rows up.
My question was actually very similar about what we can do personally to kind of self-advocacy. But I did have another question about, we talked a lot about like the social and institutional differences or biases, like the pink versus blue thing. And maybe this is just kind of anecdotal evidence, but I feel like if a girl child or termed a tomboy, whatever, they define themselves in opposition to those kind of ideals of like femininity and like pink and playing with dolls and things like that. I was wondering if you could address that kind of question of whether success or women that have succeeded in fields of science, or whether you personally have experienced having to kind of compromise your like female identity or femininity, whatever you'd like that term to mean, and adopt more like masculine traits to succeed?
I think that's a great question. Sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, I personally, as far as this trade-off that I was talking about a minute ago, like changing your discipline versus moving yourself ahead in it, I felt the pull to kind of, you know, dress in a more masculine way, act in a more masculine way. And as I sort of, you know, my career has gone on, I think I've loosened up more. You know, sometimes now I wear my yoga pants to the department or whatever. But I at least have felt that. And I think it is something that, it's one of these things where it probably can help you a bit if the people in power are men and you look more like them.
But yeah, I noticed that in the yeah, this picture that you put up of politicians, that all the women are wearing very, very bright clothes and they're not trying to look like the men, whereas actually the three of us are in a way trying to. But I think also, compared with, say, 30 years ago, there's far more diversity in how everybody dresses. I mean, it used to be that it was either miniskirts or midi skirts or something else, and that everyone looked the same, whereas now there's an enormous range of different styles and fashions. So I think in general it's easier for women to find their own way of dressing or of behaving.
So that rings a bell with me, because I had a graduate student, very brilliant woman, very feminine, and she went to do a postdoc with someone in another laboratory in the United States. And one day he said to her, "You don't even try to dress gender neutral." So there is that pressure. But in fact, it turned out to be great. She then came back to work with me again after that. And we use toys to see what toys children who have different amounts of androgen exposure prenatally might prefer. And there's a finding in the literature that suggests that boys like boys' toys over girls' toys more than girls like girls' toys over boys' toys. And she said, "Well, these toys are all wrong. These aren't the toys that girls really like. I'll get you the toys that girls really like." So she brought in these super feminine toys. And if you use those super feminine toys, then the girls and the boys are the same in how much they like their own toys over the other toys. So I think it's a great example of diversity being part of a successful story.
So quickly turning back to the idea of like what you can do to sort of enter science. I mean, looking around this room, I noticed there are a lot of young women, probably a lot of you are thinking about moving into STEM fields. There are many, many kind of hacks for academic success or success in research or success in medicine. One of the most important things you can do is to get a good mentor to sort of guide you and to give you specific advice across cases about, you know, how to deal with the particular issues of being women, but also just the sort of general issues of being a scientist. And if you can get, you know, an established female mentor, that's great, but if you can get an understanding male mentor, that's also wonderful. So that is maybe the most important thing to, you know, moving forward, especially in an academic career.
Patricia, would you like to say anything just to conclude?
I agree absolutely on the mentoring, and again, I think that's a thing that it sort of has to improve exponentially, because now there are far more senior women around who are very, very willing to act as mentors, and so I think cumulatively the situation is improving and will improve in the future. So I would really counsel against being too pessimistic about the situation.
Well, I think we'll close on that very positive note. Thanks to all of the audience members who asked questions, and if you'll thank me in joining Professor Melissa Hines, Dr. Patricia Farah, Dr. Taylor McDonough.